You're listening to the Lean Built Podcast. I'm Jay.
And I'm Andrew. In this podcast, we discuss our manufacturing companies, lean principles,
and the freedom that we're pursuing in life and business.
So Jay, I was talking to another business owner in my town yesterday at my Vistage meeting, and the question came up, and so I want to ask you, would you ever own an Airbnb in your area or a condo specifically for the purpose of giving out-of-town vendors or clients who want to come for collaborative meetings, shop tours, visits, anything, a place to stay? Have you ever thought about that?
I mean, that's not something that would ever come up in my line of business, but I would say that's a math problem. Most problems are math problems. Even you get down to the nitty gritty of, you know, I really want this. Well, it's theoretically possible to get everything in life. It just takes more time or takes more resources, more sacrifice. I thought you were going to ask, would I ever have an Airbnb managed locally just for more income? The answer to that is absolutely not. In fact, in 2018, we moved into our present house and we had an option to either keep our old house and rent it out and be cash flow positive, like good cash flow positive, like at least $1,000 a month in Southern California, which is becoming more and more rare. I know to stay in my lane. And I go, I am not a landlord. I was a long distance, long-term landlord for 13 years. We used to live in Austin, Texas. I think I mentioned that in a few podcasts ago. We kept that house for 13 years, rented out and managed by a property manager, and then sold it, did what's called a 1031 exchange. So the sales of that, we didn't pay capital gains. It went onto the down payment of my building. Mm-hmm. Great plan. Could have never planned it out myself. But I just know that I think I'd rather own stocks if I'm going to put money aside or money into something. Just it's a distraction when you start having to deal with people in a different industry where that's not your primary focus. So I'm a manufacturer. I'm an entrepreneur. I am not a landlord. I'm fine not having property and missing out on that opportunity. Like I've signed off on that. This is Jay Pearson is not a landlord to anyone other than my company that's in my building.
Totally fair.
Yeah. What was the discussion?
The discussion was, I was thinking about, because we're going to be talking about some hiring in this episode. We've added several remote employees to the Henry Holsters team in the past few weeks, which is new territory for us. I'm trying to figure out, it's a whole new area where we have optimization and lean improvements to make, which is exciting because we have some weekly Zoom meetings already. We've been doing those for a while with clients to follow up on project development and planning for the future and different things. But I haven't had to manage internal team meetings that are primarily remote. Mm-hmm. And we're trying to figure out what's the right balance because these guys are all in Ohio.
Okay.
So they're within a day's drive. It's not like having a remote employee in California.
Right.
And so it's not unfeasible to have them down to our shop for on-sites fairly regularly.
Okay.
And the question is, how much value is an on-site worth? How much money is it worth spending to get people here on-site versus having them on Zoom? Mm-hmm. How do we transmit and maintain the company culture we want for employees who are primarily remote, who didn't start here and then move away, having already been in the groove, but are coming on board as full-time remote employees from the get-go? Mm-hmm. There's a bunch of interesting things there, like how many meetings? How long should the meetings be? How many people should be on deck in each meeting? What scope should each meeting have? How are we going to track deliverables and communicate between meetings? I talked with a couple people in my Vistage group yesterday because a bunch of them have employees in multiple states. Mm-hmm. And so I had a lot of questions for my group, like, all right, those of you who have remote employees, especially those of you who have a lot of remote employees, what are the top couple things I need to think about? And one thing that I heard from every single one of them was, make sure you have a clear plan for channels of communication. Because if you've got email and Slack and text messaging and Signal and you're all in a Facebook group together and somebody likes to use a carrier pigeon and sometimes you're on Discord, and like if you have too many disparate channels, people end up sort of self-siloing into the channels they like to use, the ones that are convenient to them that fit in with their normal life and use of technology. But then you end up always wondering, like, hey, just like me with my five legal pads, or 8 legal pads or however many legal pads I had. I don't even know how many legal pads.
Yeah.
I've got all this information, but I'm never sure. I can never say definitively until I've checked them all where I need to go to get any particular piece.
Yeah, that's a problem. Yeah, like my wife, she's a victim of that. She joins all these different, whether it's a homeschooling group or a church group or just a random family. You know, she's on WhatsApp, she's on Signal, she's on the Band app, she's on Telegram, then of course the traditional SMS. But really the greater principle is getting things done. David Allen, he says one spot, it's got to be consistent.
Yeah. Not that you can't engage in all those places, but you have to have a way to hub them together.
Yeah, for at least yourself. Yeah. So, really quick, your remote employees, are they in close proximity to each other?
Yes. The three of them are all in the same geographic region. They're going to be working remote basically from home offices, mm-hmm. but it's not impossible that they could have in-person meetings as their little team mm-hmm. separately more frequently. But in terms of getting our team to know them and them to really know us, mm-hmm. there is no substitute, in my opinion, for some amount of ongoing face-to-face time to build trust, to build the ability to have candor. The value of reading somebody's body language when you're in the room and talking with them uh-huh. is so valuable. Even if that isn't the majority of your communication, having had that enough times, you have a feel, mm-hmm. you can gauge a person via Zoom much better if you've spent a bunch of time with them in real life.
Well, someday in the future, we'll be able to do meetings across the country video, like we're in the same room. Wouldn't that be an amazing place to live? Anyways, facetiously speaking, what have you considered a remote office for the three of them?
I think they're spread out up to an hour from between the four of us two.
Okay.
So they're not like right in each other's backyard.
Yeah.
So it would be more reasonable to say, hey, we'd like you guys to have once a week, an afternoon where you get together at some central location mm-hmm. and work together. But it's not like, oh yeah, we all live in the same block. So we'll just find a co-working space and book a conference room and meet there regularly.
Right.
But the idea of if I have employees coming from out of state once or twice a month for a couple days at a time, if that's a hotel bill, that adds up really fast. Mm-hmm. And if it's an Airbnb, I mean, I can look around. There's plenty of Airbnbs in Bloomington because it was a college town. So families and parents and grandparents are always visiting their kids in college. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of Airbnbs, but you also have to watch the calendar because like this next weekend is graduation weekend for IU. Literally everything in the entire town is booked up.
And a significant radius, I'm going to think.
Yeah. And rates on anything you can find are like, it's like eclipse rates. Just everything's super high.
I still feel the sting of missing the eclipse. But it's
But if I owned an Airbnb, I could preferentially reserve it for scheduled dates that I want to put on the calendar for it.
Yeah.
And then the employees have the same space to come to every time. It's a thing I'm thinking about, like, how much would that lower the hurdle, the threshold of getting them here in person if we could provide them with a consistent thing?
Yeah. Are you allowed to do business or is it kind of discouraged to do business with other Vistage partners?
It's not... I don't frown upon explicitly encouraged or discouraged.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. In my group, it kind of is because it's not kind of not the point. It's not for networking. But you know, there might be an opportunity there where you guys form an LLC and then go in on an Airbnb and you just say, hey, you know, the fourth Tuesday through Thursday of the month, Henry Holsters has that.
A timeshare.
Yeah.
Essentially.
Yeah. Essentially.
I have a condo.
Right. Yeah. I don't know. Without knowing any details beyond that, if just being completely objective, I would think, it sounds like someone wants to kind of have property because maybe property's available. Like it doesn't feel like 100%.
I mean,
like a pure motive.
If our company model depended on us having guests in on a weekly basis and we just had people here all the time, it would totally make sense to own a house or own an apartment that was constantly available.
Yeah.
But that was not a short-term rental of any kind. It's just, this is essentially company housing that's available as a resource.
Yeah.
But we're not in that position currently. So it was an interesting thought exercise. I've never wanted to own an Airbnb, but I am interested in finding new and better ways to reduce the friction of getting out of towners here and having their time here be productive and relaxing and having it not feel like, every time they come, it's like $1,000 out of my pocket.
Right. Yeah.
So,
yeah, you know, this is the world of bigger institutions. You know, I was just talking to a friend that was at a museum in Washington, D.C., mm-hmm. and the museum had not just a place for out of state, out of country, international dignitaries to come in and stay, but they had several apartments, like up to six or eight, you know, luxurious apartments. Here in Simi Valley, we have the Reagan Presidential Library, and there's a place where dignitaries can stay, or at least Nancy Reagan back in the day, or the Reagan family. And then you look at, heck, even Disneyland has a secret living space on Disneyland property, from what I've heard. And it was kind of, I think, for the Disney family. So the concept in itself is, I think, for guests. So I think your Visage partner is on the right track. Yeah. And why not have it if it makes sense on paper for you
yeah.
to be in on that, so that it only costs you, you know, $500,000 a month? I don't know. Airline airfares alone, it's, you're going to be paying, but
yeah, it's an interesting thing just because it's a new question for us. And so I'm not coming to it with any prior experience of how we've done this before. It's just like, oh, well, mm-hmm. this new opportunity, this new type of structure mm-hmm. raises new questions, but also opens new opportunities up.
Yeah. Yeah.
So speaking of hiring, you yeah. said you have done or are doing some right now.
We're in the thick of it. Yeah.
In the thick of it. What does that mean?
Okay. So, gosh, I feel like I'm teasing the audience. And I've mentioned that I have a second company that I started about a year ago. I'll get there. We're going to do a social media launch. It's going to be on the YouTube channel. I can't disclose it yet, but we've hired probably about, over the past year, year and a half, probably close to half a dozen, maybe eight people. And we're hiring right now. We're hiring six more. So we're going from a team of five. Is that right? Yeah. It's essentially to a team of, well, for now, the short path is a team of four, another four guys. And just going through the route of Indeed, we're hiring at Pearson. You know, I mentioned a while back that we're hiring an apps guy. Mm-hmm. I've been interviewing lots of people with that. That's why we were supposed to podcast yesterday, as a matter of fact, but it just got loaded up or a couple of days ago or something. Just with the hiring process, because it is tedious. It's important. We're slowing down our hiring process, because I think in the past we've hired too quickly, especially okay. when they're personal referrals. And the personal referral is great from one of our other teammates, but we really need to kind of do a little bit more background. Not that our referrals have been bad, it's just we didn't follow the process. So okay. it's tedious. I'm actually enjoying it. I think the process is great. So we break it up into kind of three processes. The first one is just go through the 50 resumes that we get. And I don't even narrow those down. It's my office manager and another guy, Wyatt. They'll go through those. And then we'll schedule phone interviews with me where we just talk. You know, I just want to talk to you because, you know, we're strangers.
Yep.
And then the third would probably be like a skills test and just maybe in person if they're local, or Zoom if they're not. And then just kind of looking around like, did we cover all of our bases? Have we thought through everything? At the other company, it's also manufacturing, and we have them do the Lego test, which is great. And we had to put a time limit on it because most people were just going over, or just some people, it's speed versus quality. And so some people would finish quicker and it was mistakes all over. Mm-hmm. And then you have people that go outside of the hour timeline. It's only like a little over 100 pieces, this Lego. It's a Lego Technic.
Yep.
And at 1 hour, you know, if you go over that, that's problematic. And it's going to be one of those things that we do infrequently. So continually improving on the hiring process and screening process is going to be something it's just taking a lot of my time right now, mm-hmm. Along with the new products we're trying to release and all that stuff. But yeah, that's been the latest.
Gotcha. I'd be curious to know, could you send me a link? I want to see exactly what that Technic set is.
Yeah.
Not that I'm going to suddenly start using it, but I'm curious.
Yeah.
When you mention mistakes, I'm in the middle of reading Don Norman's The Design of Everyday Things.
Uh-huh.
Which is fascinating. Have you read it?
No.
Okay. Really cool book. Chapter 7, I think.
Okay.
Is about, chapter 5 is titled Human Error? No, Bad Design. Ooh. And it's about what kinds of mistakes people make. And he breaks errors down into two categories: slips and mistakes. Mm-hmm. And a slip is when you want to do something, but do something else. Mm-hmm. Like his example is, I pour some milk in my coffee and then put my mug of coffee back in the fridge. Okay. Like, correct action, wrong item.
Yeah.
I knew what I was trying to do, but I did something different.
Uh-huh.
And a mistake is where you get the plan wrong. Misanalyze the problem. You're missing in some information.
Bad
you
process.
Do all the steps you intend to do,
yeah.
but they're not actually what you should be doing for that thing.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the interesting things he points out, this kind of paradox, is that those little slip mistakes where you mean to do one thing but do something else, those actually become more common the more highly skilled and trained a person is, because those slips happen right at the line between conscious attention and automaticity.
Yeah.
Where you're doing something on autopilot and you just get in the flow. Mm-hmm. Like just last week, I was getting changed at the end of the day and I took off my socks and I went to go toss them in the hamper, and instead I just threw them right in the little trash can.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, it's a container.
Sure.
They're about the same size and shape. It's in my room.
Yep.
And I'm just like, I'm running on 10% mental power and these go in the container now, that I threw my nice wool socks in the trash. And my wife's like, are you throwing those away? I'm like, what?
Sweetie, it's a slip.
That's a slip.
Okay.
And the idea that as your level of expertise increases, that certain kinds of slips are more likely to occur because you are processing a lot of the information and choosing the actions unconsciously.
Sure.
That was really interesting to me. So I really enjoy the book. And his contention is the best designs are basically invisible.
Mm-hmm.
They're so intuitive. They're so seamless and frictionless to use that you don't even realize you've encountered design.
Mm-hmm.
You don't even think that you've encountered something that was intentionally made that way. It's just like, wow, that just worked.
It just happened. Yeah.
Just worked.
Yeah.
And the degree to which little visual cues, color cues, shapes of things can have a huge impact on how much mental energy they take to use.
Yep.
The ones that stand out to us are things that are in the mediocre to awful range in the spectrum, because everything good, it just flows right past us. It's seamless.
Yeah, that's good.
And so really fun book. I've been enjoying it a lot.
You know what came to mind while you're saying that is in our assembly process has gotten better and better and better over the years. It's really easy to grab the wrong fastener or no fastener, even worse. So we have these, we call them build trays, where we pre-populate all the components. Got that from a Harley Davidson tour, where if you finish this step and there's components left over, you missed it. And so the first thing you do is you very easily, and it's worth the extra time, you populate this board, and we have 3D printed boards. Quick side note, we can talk about it later, but we're launching a second channel that shows all the kind of behind the scenes stuff. And so, you know, we'll highlight these build trays and people go, wow, it seems like it's over processing. And we go, well, it could be over processing if it wasn't necessary, but it's proper processing to populate these build trays. And really, when you're populating, we don't do one at a time. We have, like, when we build our PPSs, five at a time. And so you just grab a handful of fasteners and just put them in the little holes, you know, they're all quarter 28. And it's just worth it because, you know, you can get a phone call, you can go to lunch, you can space out, you can get, what'd you say? Like when your brain gets autonomous?
Yeah. Automaticity.
Automaticity. Yeah. That whole thing. That's part of the process. That's where you populate the build trays and then you pull from them. Yeah. That's great.
We were just talking about build trays. We have a few kits that we build in fairly high volume. And I actually posted on our Instagram today a KPI number that I'm really proud of. But there's also, in the margins, there's always problems. Mm. So we were crunching our numbers for March, and our fulfillment staff got 99.46% of orders out in one business day.
Wow. That's amazing.
It's just incredible.
Is that tracked through ShipStation?
Tracked through ShipStation. Okay. So we export everything, we crunch it and filter it down. We exclude wholesale and dealer shipments from that list because we're talking about how we process retail website orders.
Yeah.
A lot of dealer and wholesale things are built to order, so there's a manufacturing lead time in there. And if we included that data, it would just make the whole thing look a lot worse.
Yep.
And it's a
really
different thing. And the expectation for wholesale customers is they place a wholesale order for their custom parts and we're going to manufacture them sometime that week and ship them. We're still fast as an OEM for wholesale stuff, but we're not like oh, 42 minutes after you placed your order, here's your tracking number and your photo. Mm-hmm. But earlier this week, we had what in the design book they call a Swiss cheese problem, where like one thing manages to just perfectly thread its way through all the holes and get out the other side. So we had a kit that got built and it was missing a key component. And that did not get caught in QC. Mm. And that kit got put on the shelf and an employee picked it, scanned it. Shipping employees aren't responsible for verifying contents of the kit. Mm-hmm. It's assumed that if it got went through production and went through QC and it's on the shelf, it's good. So, but two different people handled it in shipping and neither you could maybe have noticed because part of the packaging is clear. You might have been able to spot that this component was missing. Either way, it got shipped, customer received it, was trying to send an email because this is an OEM part for another for a third party. Mm-hmm. Was trying to send an email to the contact form on that company's website. They were having a website update. Their contact form was broken for the entire afternoon. Mm. So the customer was really frustrated. Eventually got an email through to us. We went back and checked the photo from our shipping scale. And sure enough, I could see through the clear packaging that that component was clearly missing.
Wow.
Totally our fault.
Yeah.
But the packaging photo was a key piece of information for me to verify. Absolutely, yes.
Yeah.
At this time, when we sent this out, it was incomplete. We dropped the ball.
Uh-huh. Wow.
But this whole thing, we found out about it near the end of the day. It's like 3:45 in the afternoon and we cut off shipping at 4 o'clock and drive packages to the post office. And so we were rushing around. We were building up a replacement kit with some extra stuff as a thank you and apology and the things she was missing. And then I went to go sit back down at the customer service software and send an email back to the customer and say, hey, here's what happened. We apologize. Here's your updated tracking number. And we were going to update that missing component and ship it overnight express. Mm-hmm. And I hop back into our shipping software. It's now like 4:20. Everyone else has left. And I'm looking for her tracking number for the second shipment. And I can't find a tracking number for it. And I go into the awaiting shipment queue. And her warranty rush shipment is still sitting in the awaiting shipment queue. Mm-hmm. And I went, oh no. Like that needs to go out today.
Yeah.
And so I quickly texted the employee who had been handling the order. And I was like, hey, did you get that packaged up? And she's like, yeah, I packaged it. It went in the mailbag. It left the building. And I'm like, it doesn't look like a label got generated yet. And she goes, oh no, did I package that up and put it in the mailbag without a label? I'm like, I don't know. I don't have any way to verify that. I'm going to repack that rush order again, print a label, get in my car and drive to the post office right now.
Yeah.
So it's like 4:40. I just finished repacking the order. I get in my car with just this one package. I drive into the post office. I go pop it inside. Mm-hmm. And we know all the ladies who work the counter there because we're there every day.
Yeah.
And I walked up and said, hey, did Allie drop off a bag of mail and there was an express overnight in there that didn't have a label? She goes, yep, here it is. And she reaches under the counter and pulls it out. And there's that package. Didn't have a label on it. So I've got a duplicate of it in my hand with a label. And I just swapped her one for one. Please send this one, scan it. And then I went and sat down and wrote an email to the customer apologizing for the mistake, apologizing that the website contact form was down, explaining what we were shipping, including her updated tracking number. Mm-hmm. But it was like, we normally are operating at a really, really high level.
Yeah.
And yet in this one day, like four things happened wrong in a row on the same day, all to the same customer.
Yeah.
And her experience was so wildly different from everybody else who ordered from us that day. It's like, wow.
Gosh, that is crazy. Weird. I think we've talked about that very early on in the podcast where just a pile of mistakes or slips happens to the same customer. I just think like this happened one time with Tolster, you know, our mutual friend. And he was so forgiving. I said, dude, I'm sorry. Like you're a bad luck customer. Another customer was where we actually put Carlos on a plane to Phoenix because it was like, hey, we're not sure about this. Oh, sorry. It looks like it's, you know, missing this. We're going to send you the part. Hey, we did this. It's still not working. Oh, that's a separate thing. There were like three mistakes. And I said, grab it. And it was a PPS base, like our flagship product. Carlos, take a PPS. I booked you a flight, round trip, Phoenix. Please hand deliver it. Buy them lunch. Do all that stuff. This is crazy. And I feel like that, like, what's up with that? Like, I feel like in our experience, that's the norm. Do people have bad days? Do we have just really bad luck? Is our luck piled on? Like, is it their bad luck? I don't know. That's wild.
I'm not sure how that happens, but it definitely is a thing.
Uh-huh.
That sometimes everything just goes wrong.
Yeah.
And in some cases, it is that the first mistake takes you out of the lane.
Uh-huh.
And the rest of the time you're trying to solve this problem, you are driving on the shoulder of the road.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, other problems occur because you're driving on the shoulder of the road.
Yep.
You're outside the normal process. You don't have your normal guardrails. Anytime you're doing something that's one of one under time pressure,
mm-hmm.
It should be like, okay, we're on the high wire right now.
Yep. That's like in the Paul Akers version of how you teach lean,
mm-hmm.
And where his thing is when you find defects, you get to the point where you find defects, it causes you to over process. And then you're also wasting motion. It's that, so, you know, you shouldn't be over processing to fix a defect. And when you over process, it's a non-standardized, non-documented, it is not a process. So you're wasting motion. You're just not, it's not at the forefront of your mind.
Yeah. The stuff stacks up and the problem runs away.
It does. Yeah.
Real quick.
Yeah, absolutely.
Speaking of documentation, not having a process, I read a fascinating article in The Atlantic this week
mm-hmm.
about Boeing.
Okay.
And nice. It was all about how the corporate culture changed and the gradual outsourcing of almost everything except for final assembly led to a company that was spearheaded and run by people who had never built or designed anything.
Right. Yeah.
And in the course of the article, they referred to a white paper that was written, presented in February 2001
mm-hmm.
by Dr. L.J. Hartsmith, who was a Boeing, worked for Boeing.
Mm-hmm.
And his entire paper was about the looming dangers of excessive outsourcing and their impact on cost overruns and quality control.
Mm-hmm.
And like literally everything he warned about in that paper is exactly what happened to Boeing over the next 22 years.
Wow.
Like, to a T.
Very prophetic. Well, it's not prophetic because you've this is what humans do when they prioritize dollars and speed and things like that.
And the thing that one of the things he pointed out that I thought was most interesting that I'd never really thought about is if the driving justification for the work,
mm-hmm.
you're going to have to do new additional work yourself to check their work.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And what that tends to do is like, okay, you outsource all the welding. And then your QC department has to do a ton more inspecting
mm-hmm.
than it normally would. And
yeah, guilty.
What that means then is it looks like the overhead ratio, like it looks like the things you keep, since they're all that's left, any remaining costs get loaded into those categories
mm-hmm.
and it makes the math look worse and worse and worse and worse. Like the things you're hanging on to are becoming more and more and more expensive, which drives another round of outsourcing,
mm-hmm.
which further concentrates overhead costs, which drives more outsourcing. And it's this vicious cycle, but it's actually a distortion because the outsourcing creates the concentration of overhead,
right.
not
That's
the
right.
other way around.
Yeah. It's just you're moving process outside. You're seeing the dollar go down, but you're unable to calculate the dollars that are going up on the inside. You know, we had this same exact issue. We thought, let's start outsourcing the bushings that go into every one of our pallets.
Mm-hmm.
And we used a company, a local company, and they were producing them and we buy them in 1,000 at a time, you know, maybe quarterly, I don't know the numbers, but often. And we would get calls like, hey, this pallet feels a little sticky. Really? Hey, do you have a set of gauge pins? Can you just throw it in? Wow. Nope. We're going to replace those. And so we started having to 100% check, not like batch check, but literally 100% check, because if we send out a bad pallet, it's no excuse for me to say, well, I'm sorry, Mr. Customer, you got unlucky, because we did check every 10th bushing.
You just got bushing number 9.
Yeah, sorry. That doesn't work. That's not excusable. So I literally spent thousands of dollars, if not close to $5,000 on an air gauge mm-hmm. so that we could check the ID more efficiently. Good set of mics and a mic stand for the OD. And at one point we go, wait, every time there's a bushing issue. Well, first of all, when we were 100% checking the bushings that came back from this manufacturer, it would take my shipping manager, Elliot, or assembly guy, assembly team, they would check them. And then he would have a good, bad, and a maybe. Now, the maybe ones were like right on the edge of the tolerance. Mm-hmm. And he's like, but sometimes like in the morning, it's going to measure right on. In the afternoon, it's bad because it's warmer and just these little thermal variations. So then what that was causing was for him to go get one of our senior machinists to discuss it. And then it would be elevated or escalated to me. And so now you've got at least three guys talking about it, two of which are like highly compensated and, you know, having to make a decision, like a judgment call on something. So we just pulled all that work back in and it just runs through our process. Armando, our main lathe guy, he's a rock star, of course, and we just don't have those issues. And he 100% checks the bushings at the machine with the air gauge. I suppose we would have needed it anyways, but it's a lot better than pins. Yeah. But yeah, no, that's something that is a misconception when you start to get quote unquote successful. So you start outsourcing. We actually used another vendor, great vendor. They made some components for us, high volume, low tolerance, easy stuff. It's screw machine work. And it came in and it wasn't packaged well. And out of like the 6,000 pieces that we ordered, we only got like 4,000, 4,500. I go, okay, right there. It's not about like their process was great, great documentation, but the packaging was poor. And so we've got a bunch of, you know, 1,500 parts scattered across the United States on shipping conveyors around fulfillment centers now at this point. So again,
not ideal.
Outsourcing is difficult on so many levels. It just adds it's not less work, it adds different work.
And in this white paper, Hartsmith is not arguing that outsourcing is fundamentally bad, mm-hmm. but that if it's pursued thoughtlessly, there's a lot of easy distortion. So this quote I thought was interesting. In order to minimize the potential problems of outsourcing, it is necessary for the prime contractor, in this case Boeing, mm-hmm. to provide to the vendors on-site quality, supplier management, and technical support. And if this is not done, the performance of the prime manufacturer can never exceed the capabilities of the least efficient, least proficient supplier.
Yeah, wow.
And these costs do not vanish merely because the work itself is out of sight.
Yeah. Hit me with that title again of the book.
The book, so this is unrelated. This was from the Atlantic article about Boeing.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, I will send you a link. This was the white paper mm-hmm. that was presented internally in Boeing in 2001. Mm-hmm. But yeah, his take on the downsides, the risks of outsourcing and the ways in which it falsely shifts costs into categories that make the situation less clear. Mm-hmm. It's really interesting. Mm-hmm. So
yeah,
I've got one more quote to read. The superficial perspective might be that every internal activity that used to be related to a task that has now been outsourced is no longer necessary. Mm-hmm. But even that is not true. And worse, it fails to acknowledge all the new internal tasks that had not previously existed. Mm. All the extra work you now have to do to manage outsourcing. Mm-hmm. To add insult to injury, contemporary accounting practices do not allow these unavoidable additional costs to be billed against that particular item of work because that is no longer identified as an in-house task. So these charges are allocated instead as overhead to any of the remaining in-house work. And this misrepresentation of true costs furthers the illusion that outside production is cheaper than anything done inside, building pressure to ship even more work offsite until there isn't any left. The irony of the situation is that it is so easy to understand in the extreme. Suppose that a manufacturer had succeeded in outsourcing all of the work that it wished to isolate from the preferred task of systems integrator. The unallocatable costs from the huge amount of outsourced work will now appear as overhead on the few remaining tasks like sales and product support, confirming that these are even less profitable than manufacturing had been when the outsourcing spiral began. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was sitting up last night reading this and going, oh man, like the idea that the generation before us in manufacturing got absolutely clobbered by this stuff. Mm-hmm. And that companies, rather than embracing lean, rather than in their people, mm-hmm. rather than finding ways to make more with less, they just decided to send the work out.
Print POs.
Yeah. And the other really funny irony is he said that the desire to find labor markets where capital can get you more labor, where labor is underpriced. Uh-huh. He goes, it's a self-defeating cycle. The reason labor is underpriced in those markets is because there isn't work there. Mm-hmm. The second you start putting work there,
they have all the same problems we have.
You have all of a sudden upward pressure on the pricing and you quickly consume that savings and you've added all these transportation costs. You've added all these other risks and coordination issues. And the only way to manage that, to reduce those extra costs is to co-locate the outsourced factory right next to the original one, in which case you're back in the exact same labor pool with the exact same labor costs. You've gotten nothing except more diffused responsibility.
There you go.
So it's been a hoot, but certainly, like, my uncle was a longtime machinist for GE in Erie, Pennsylvania, building locomotive engines. And that entire thing just got crushed. You know, for him, they had a multi-building site, and they used to do all their own casting of these huge blocks of metal for locomotive parts. They used to do all that casting on site, and then it all got outsourced. They started bringing in all their castings from overseas. And he said they started wrecking machine tools because the quality of the castings was so inconsistent. Like, they would just hit chunks of hardened material.
Wow.
They were just in the middle of these castings. They were, the quality control for the castings was just non-existent. And it's like, yeah, sure, the castings are cheaper, but half of our machining centers are down.
Right. Yeah.
Because we just keep blowing them up. And then what that makes it look like is it makes it look like operating your own machine shop is exceptionally costly. Man, the maintenance costs are out of control. We should outsource the machining too.
Yeah.
And that's what they did. They outsourced the machining. And the idea that you broke the machining by outsourcing the material procurement and then feeding junk into the machining cells and then destroying all your equipment. It's like, it didn't occur to anybody.
Yeah.
I think all the machinists knew it.
Of course.
But nobody who was making those decisions knew it, which was wild.
You know, I was thinking Boeing is going to be the poster child that brings a lot of this thinking to the mainstream, the forefront of the discussions of us in manufacturing. It threw me back to the morning meeting this morning where I used an example of a waste. We had a local machine shop. Some people kind of took the initiative to say, hey, we're local. Can we just stop by to do a tour, just catch a glimpse of it? Yes, we'll do that for you. Just hearing different horror stories from their shop that failed to advance. They didn't have any practices, let alone lean. They just didn't invest in their people. They were doing pretty much everything wrong. And for us, we walked away from that tour. You know, we want to inspire. That's one of our principal things that we pursue. We want to inspire people both digitally and in person. But the takeaway that I mentioned in the morning meeting, you know, I alluded to something they were doing, but I said, you know, guys, it's really easy for us to point the finger at, you know, XYZ machine. That's not their name, just filler name. But at the same time, we don't want to get apathetic about this. I said, you know, they came in, they told us stories, and we laugh and we scoff at the overprocessing. But guess what? There's overprocessing that we do right now that we don't even see.
Yep.
And when we're prideful and we don't check our egos at the door, we think we're doing everything right. I just think that it's one of those things where it takes like good, full, big picture examination of everything you're doing in a shop, all the way from purchasing to, you know, what do you do with your literal waste, like your scrap and your trash? Like, how do those move? How do they get out of your way? How do they move out of your facility? Move out of your way so that you can produce what you're supposed to be doing. In your case, holsters, me, work holding products. Another thing that I thought of to kind of land this plane, no pun intended, but in manufacturing is us manufacturers, at least those of us that have machine tools, we already are outsourcing, for example, our cutting tools. We outsource our material sourcing. And that was one of the things, you know, I couldn't understand why our handful of local distributors, three or four that we buy from in the area, why they didn't have cutting tools in stock. Look, you list it on your website. You have the rep from XYZ company come in and tell me about it. Great. Let's buy it. Oh, it's coming from the East Coast, or it's coming from Germany. It's going to be about a week. Well, we kind of don't operate that way. So we insourced something that was just automatically outsourced, a local supply shop. And we said, these are the tools we need. They go in this cabinet. Essentially, it's just like, what do you call it? The vending machines, the in-house vending machines, to insource our own supply chain. And had we not taken a step back, I don't think we were as active as considering it as we were having in this conversation. But if we didn't take a step back and go, wait a minute, these three distributors never have these tools, drills, inserts in stock. We know that we use them on a regular basis. We need to take charge of this. We need to control and not have low inventory or no inventory. We need to have the appropriate amount of inventory, not excess inventory, the appropriate amount right here, so we don't have to wait. Again, one of the eight wastes.
Yeah, I've been thinking and talking a lot with my staff about vertical integration. as a concept. And we're not trying to do like the Henry Ford own the plantation that grows the rubber trees that produce the rubber that makes your tires.
Right.
I'm not trying to go to that degree.
Yeah. Owning the forest for the wood in the car.
But yeah, but every time we've had some process that's been a problem, either an outside vendor or a supply chain thing, if we can bring it in closer and participate with it more directly, even if we don't bring it entirely in-house, it's just like, it's the same effect as making an internal batch production number smaller. It gets a lot easier to manage the closer it is. Like, we had one vendor that we deal with where every time we need to talk to them, they are on the opposite side of the world from us, which means every single email takes 24 hours to get a response, because we email during our business hours and they email us back at 2 a.m.
Oh, literal other side of the world.
Yeah, literal other side of the world.
Okay.
We email them back at 9 a.m. They email us back at 1:30 the following morning. It's like every single email takes a day because we have zero overlap in our office hours. And that doesn't matter how well you communicate, that problem doesn't go away.
Yeah.
Every single multi-step communication takes days.
Yeah. I pulled up our, we call it our mission, vision, values document. It's kind of the operating framework for just everything in the company. And we do have a vendor relations kind of policy or guidelines. Two things stood out. We will recognize our vendors as an extension of our manufacturing capabilities and value them as part of our company, because it's really easy to kind of poop on your vendors. But also our fourth bullet point down, we will establish good communication and provide regular feedback on their services. And that's something that has to happen. If you're going to outsource, man, you have to, I'm saying you, like, we choose to have regular integrations, regular conversations. Most of the time I'm like, hey, these guys rushed it when we asked them, because we never rush things through, because we don't want to apply our waste of falling behind and cause, you know, have to wait and push them through. We don't want to push our vendors, but when they do perform, get them flowers, get them cookies, get them Starbucks, whatever. Like, we do want to have those good relations, and it does start with good communication. That's just a core tenet. So,
yeah. How often do you have vendors come to your shop? Is it important to you that they see what you do?
The regular vendors, like our anodizers, no, it's not. The material vendors, at least the outside salespeople stop by at least maybe once a month, maybe every 2 months. I always grab those guys because I'm like, tell me about the market conditions. They're kind of a great source for kind of gossip in the area. Like, you know, who's doing well, what's going on? Because we're not compete. We don't have a local competition. We have a local base of potential customers, machine shops. And if we're slow and they're not, okay, it's a national thing. If they're slow and we're not, it's a local thing. So that's what I'm always trying to keep, you know, my finger on the pulse of. But, you know, when it comes down to distributors and they say, hey, so-and-so is from the factory, they're flying out. Yes, absolutely. Let's meet. I want to know. I want you guys to know what we do. I want to know how you do it. We go deep. And that probably happens every couple months when you have a vendor, like a factory rep come in.
We had a sales guy, well, I guess a regional rep from one of our vendors who had never been to our shop. Nobody from their company had ever set foot here. We only started doing business with them in 2023. And he's like, I'm going to be in your area next week. Can I stop by? I'm like, sure. Come on, stop by. And we had just been in a situation with them earlier this spring where I had been less than a week away from canceling a 12-month blanket PO and booting them as a vendor, because they'd given us three notices of delay on a single material shipment that we were waiting on, and we were down to the wire. I was buying, it was nylon webbing, I was buying thousands of yards of a backup material from a competitor to keep on our shelf as a reserve parachute in case these guys did not come through, because I could not afford to be out of it. And so the rep came and I gave him the tour, and he met all the sewing employees and looked at our operation. And then I said to him very directly, I said, I want you to understand that back at this date in February, we were less than a week away from dropping you guys completely. And to say that to him, not in a threatening way, like, I hope you understand, but just
context.
Now you've seen what we do. And because you guys were repeatedly late on that critical delivery, I was about to be done doing business with you. And he looked around and he said, that makes total sense. It doesn't look like anything here waits on anything. And for him, that was an incredibly valuable piece of context to be in our shop and see how we run it. And I've had a little follow-up conversation with him since then. And he commented on it again. He's like, it was really helpful for me to see how you guys operate and how you're using the stuff that we're selling you. Mm-hmm. Because we're doing single piece flow just in time. We're sewing those parts for an internal customer, which is our assembly department. And it was so different from what he's used to seeing. I think a lot of stuff in the textile industry is just people at sewing machines just cranking out piles and piles and piles and piles of stuff. Mm-hmm. And we're doing all basically entirely pull production, cutting the webbing, heat sealing it, sewing it, assembling it, and then handing it off to assembly as a subcomponent on demand in real time every day.
Yeah.
And so there's very little WIP anywhere in the building, in the sewing stuff.
Yeah.
And him looking at that and going, okay, yeah, I can see how if we were late on webbing, you suddenly have nothing here. You don't have pallets of already sewn stuff. There's no other inventory. The inventory is the raw material on spools. And if we're late on that, the whole thing stops.
Right.
So it was good. I don't usually actively pursue trying to get vendors in here, but I feel like we're getting to a point where we probably should do more of that if we can do it without it being an excessive cost on our time.
Yeah.
Because to the degree that we're different in whatever ways from their other customers, I want them to have a place in their head to park us. Uh-huh. And know that we might ask for different things or value different things than their average customer does.
That's good.
Anyway,
yeah.
I feel like that's a good place to wrap for today.
I agree.
Next episode, I'm going to have some more quotes from that book on the design of everyday things because I am sitting down with it a little bit every day and making progress and really enjoying it.
Fantastic.
I did just send you the links for the Boeing article and that white paper.
Got them.
On outsourcing. So great. If you have time and want a depressing medium depth dive into the downfall of Boeing and the gradual corruption of their corporate culture.
Yeah.
The difference between Boeing being run by engineers and then transitioning to being run by executives and accountants is like two completely different companies.
Yeah, absolutely. Company culture is so important. Yep.
Anyway,
hop down.
I'll talk to you later, Jay.
All right.
Thanks.
See you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Lean Built Podcast. Jay and I are very grateful for you taking the time to listen in, and we hope that it was helpful to you. Please leave us a review on your podcast platform of choice, and don't forget to subscribe and share the episode with somebody you know who would enjoy it. Thanks.